and always a touch of music. Again, Finding a Voice, here every Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. Check it out. Hope to catch you there.
Hi, I'm Jack Ayala, one of CFRC's marketing assistants at the station. CFRC's funding drive is now underway and running through December 31st. Donate today and get amazing CFRC prizes. For every $5 you donate, donors also earn one more ticket for each of our weekly raffle draws, featuring prizes from wonderful local businesses including Harper's Burger Bar, Hotel Wolf Island, Kingston Canadian Film Festival, KPP Concerts, Long M. McQuaid, Mighty Birds, Pope Works, and Novel Idea. Enjoy the benefits of donating and give today via cfrc.ca.
And good afternoon. It is almost a minute, I guess, at this point, after 4 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. And this is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. And we do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today, in the first hour from a November 13th book launch and reading event held at Novel Idea Bookstore, you'll hear John Barton launching Compulsory Figures. That's his latest book of poetry. And reading from his own work that evening, you'll hear Eric Folsom. And there was a conversation that went on and Q&A as part of it, too. And in fact, this turned into a roughly 80-minute event, and so it will obviously run midway through the second hour. I will say that it will also run uninterrupted, let's put it that way. So I'm not going to break in, you're just going to hear it as if you were there that evening, I guess. And then in the second hour after that ends, I'm going to share couple of pieces of music and a bit of information and a few updates. One thing I will mention before we get into it really fully today is that we're about three quarters of the way through our annual funding drive for this year. And just a quick mention of it. It does run through December 31st, began November 1st. And we have a goal of reaching $25,000. The station, obviously, but this drive is important to me. Because without CFRC, there wouldn't be this radio show that's allowed me the privilege to honor the work of other writers and poets and share, I'm guessing, over 1,300 literary events, happenings, or interviews with other poets and writers the last nearly, well, let's just say 15 and a half years almost. For those who've already donated, and I know that there are several of you that have told me that you have, and I know that, and my heartfelt thanks to you for that. If you haven't yet, but may have been thinking about it, please check out our website, www.cfrc.ca. Click on the donate button, and it will pull up a page that has all kinds of information on it about what we plan to do with the donations this year, and all about where past funds have gone, and also even how to get it. And you can either get a tax receipt or you can get gifts, but it's all on that. Just click on www.cfrc.ca and click on the donate button, and all of that information and two very easy ways to donate are on there. Either to get a tax receipt to go one direction, and or if you want to participate and get some gifts in return and also qualify for a raffle, you can pick the other direction to take. So Very simple. We've made it very, very easy. And so there you go. Okay, let's go ahead with that. I will probably also mention the funding drive in the second hour as well. So, but what I'm going to do is a top of the hour thing I like to mention is that occasionally some poetry, music, or spoken word on this show may contain strong language, and I do try to preserve that as much as I can and to honor the integrity of both the author and the piece. And I'll announce now because I usually end it at the end of each hour, and that won't happen this hour because I don't want to interrupt the launch. But just to let you know ahead of time that all shows each week, with all shows each week, I upload to my personal blog space for them all at Finding a Voice on CFRCFM.wordpress.com. I will do that later in the evening after I get home. They do remain there for 3 years, and I think I've covered everything. And I'll tell you what, let's go ahead and just begin the book launch and reading event. Specifically, just in case you turned in a minute or two late and didn't catch it, here it is again. It's just a mention of it because you won't hear my voice again for almost an hour and 20 or 25 minutes or so. From a November 13th book launch and reading event held at Novel Idea. Now you're going to hear John Barton launching Compulsory Figures, his latest book of poetry, and reading from his own work that evening. You'll also hear Eric Folsom, who basically emceed the event. Again, there was a lot of conversation and question and answers at the end. So this, again, is roughly 80-minute event and will run uninterrupted nearly midway through the second hour. So it was a great event. I enjoyed being there that evening. Here you go. Now you can have it, too.
Justin. Hello.
Hello.
I'm Eric Folsom. That's the introduction. Oh, you know already. So I don't have to do anything. So I thought I'd read some old stuff, just to warm things up. And, for an old friend. This is a book I published back in 2001, Icon Driven. Her handful of stars flung. I need the other glasses.
Prop change.
Old. He's so fucking old. Oh my God.
You're not old if you're still seeing.
Yeah. I'm doing this on my feet. I'm not, in a rocking chair. Her handful of stars flung. There was one particular late night that I remember. Bronwyn Wallace, Ingrid de Kock, and I discussing our homes and emigration, old roots of belonging and not belonging. Bronwyn saw mostly the romance of exile, of being pushed out of countries by ideas, while Ingrid denied this was much fun at all, and deep connection to Kingston, being a local like Bron, was better, meant more. Now, the memory of Bronwyn is a candle carried inside of us. Ingrid is back in South Africa, and I cross the Thousand Islands Bridge again on a hot August day, mere embroidery on the interzone. And they say everything becomes personal eventually, every song and vision. Every child conceived, announced by human voices. Even the unreal of the media must, somewhere beyond airwaves, walk into kitchens, pour the coffee and make the toast. So our time on Earth is a pair of bent glasses, the spokes of an old wheelchair, a stone thrown at a head, anything that touches. I remember wishing for a star who could change the world, wishing for many Che Guevara's, John Lennon's, but then the great circle of women, with their arms bared, pulled the tree of heaven out by the roots to reveal we were living in clouds. Mythologies ourselves, reveling in illusions, blind always we float in the mother's hand. All the nations like cell cultures bathing and returning, waves of amniotic fluid. The world is unchanged or ruined, depending on who you've been reading. The heavenly stars are only people, Bronwyn might say. Friend of the heart, walking across the sky, we all have dreams of starfire, ambitions. What ancient metaphysical laws bent to our sacred whims? We dream of a planet made of cinnamon and nutmeg, our bare feet flying off the ground, our sleeping spouses and children abandoned, like cats curled up on the radiator, while we travel soul and body high over the world, our very footsteps igniting plasma fire, our mere substance becoming real, 9 lives trailing behind us, condensed into one simmering moment of illusion. Bronn, you had a way of addressing us directly in a poem, speaking out from the heart and belly with one more glass of bluebird wine. In your poetry, we see traces of that widening of the wild zone between the power to fight what happens to us and the power to accept what is. But what happened in your case is our longing, our leaning towards you and the piece of sky you traveled in as you were led away, swapping stories as you went. The lasting image of you trailing kitchen beauty, your most graceful pose held in place by fridge magnets and the lonesome sound of Emmylou Harris. You taught us, older sister, made us listeners to the dumb speech of sorrow in a million homes, to the solemnity of working prayers. Now you are walking across the sky, stopping here and there to heave great holes in heaven's floor, to let through the smell of horses and gardens, smoke of sacred herbs, smell of fresh bread, and the sheets of illness, bruises of abuse. I'm sure you won't want me getting too sentimental, making an angel of you and placing you everywhere at once, watching us all. You're too busy to watch, I imagine, giving the galaxies a push so they'll slowly turn, putting your spin on all the stars and calling it revolution. Come on, Bronn, you can tell me. Is this the best we can hope for? That little spark that arcs across the bitter space between life and memory. The action, the brief flicker of movement that serves as an inspiration to make things happen. When we're gone, is that all we can have? I'd much rather hope for really hearing you speak from your wild zone, the sky-ish world that must be there. Hear your actual voice from the place that lies between memory and poems. And to my surprise, there's been more than one request for this next one. I forget exactly how it started, but it was something, some sort of reasoning along the line of, like, oh, you know, you just want to be a, you know, a Nobel Prize winner or a big sort of, like, no. No, we want to be Patti Smith. We want to be Patti Smith. Something about rocker, poet, seeker. Something about Tarkovsky and the allotted function of art, which is not to serve us, not to fuck with ideas. This is the book my mother hated. But to prepare us for death. plow our souls and thrash our bodies to make us a possible receptacle of his will, make us capable of something. About the widow of death, bride of pain, her life in red and black flash tones, hair still long, only now going gray. About us long-haired, fashion-conscious poets with our undreamt dreams and virgin wrists longing to be the icons we are not. We are not weeping and tasting the ocean. We are not choking on our own vomit while thinking of loss. And we are not dedicating our lives to him unnamed because he's more precious and higher than we. We want the time to be now. We want the children to be ours. We want to live Patti Smith's life. We want Robert Mapplethorpe to be our roommate. With drugs and photography and endless spiraling night, he will never clean the bathroom once. Yet he'll bitch about the state of the kitchen. And we want to quit our own legends and move to Motor City with Frederick. Have our children and only play guitar on anniversaries and other lonely nights to remind ourselves of the way we traded the loneliness of prophecy for the loneliness of motherhood, that ultimate and destructive self-abandon, giving our blood in the form of other lives, torn from our bodies, then torn from our hands. We want to be Patti Smith, and we want to bay like hounds in pursuit of love. We want to claw at the insides of our glass bodies, punch holes in the screwed down lid of the sky, steal wafers of tragedy from the pauper's breakfast. And that is why we, skinny, long-haired posers, rock and roll nigger space monkeys, have to cast off the white snake skin of society. Why we bleed unscrupulously in the gutter. We want to be Patti Smith and emerge from passion's opium pipe spraying sweat and spit and secretions and be furies of the millennium, hypnotic fiery beings guaranteed to give everybody a hard-on that lasts well into the next century. We want to be sirens and the Greek mast and the traveler, and we will lash ourselves to the music of desire, transcending the jagged rocks, which also stand for us, teeth of victory, broken flags of despair, waving, hey, yo, get up! Yeah. We rock and roll down here with the waves, and that is why we are an aria of flesh, and why the planet crumbles around us as we demand entrance into heaven.
Okay. We need to decompress.
I'm holding up my lighter.
Okay, excellent.
Who has lighters anymore? I haven't smoked anything in decades. Okay, and I'll do a couple of things from a manuscript that I'm working on. In keeping with the musical theme, this is called Etude for Banjo and Accordion. What music don't we hear in this soundless photo? What rhythm was strummed on the five-string banjo? The girl expanding her button accordion as she sings boisterously in sepia sun. Is Grace, my grandmother, having a whale of a time, the full-throated outpouring of her joyful prime, entirely unlike the older woman I knew, pious and shy, cautious in her affections. Family lore says she changed after Albie died, her son firstborn, who lost his life to polio in the 1930s when there were no vaccines. She became religious. We became Baptists. No hint of the future stares out from this picture, except a preview of my mother's cheeks and hair, adorning Grace and Cecilia by the stone wall as they stretch out with song across the gap of time. Two little field girls in matching handmade dresses, black shoes, sailor collars, squeeze box and a banjo. I don't imagine Cecilia was more than 12. Tell the old fiddler to rosin up the bow. Fair Charlotte dwelt upon the mountainside, on top of old Smoky, covered with snow. Froggy kept a sword and pistol by his side. Railroad Bill was a mighty mean man. Music in our blood is coming down the line. Shot the lantern out of the brakeman's hand. Oh, my darling, ain't we got fun most of the time? How shall we keep a drunken sailor from harm till we meet again on that beautiful shore? And how are we gonna keep them down on the farm when there's no time to blow the man down anymore? Shenandoah, I long to see you away, you rolling river. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you mourn, the Pharaoh's army got drowned. Oh, hard times. Come again no more. The girl's father, Oscar, drove a fire engine for Ipswich. When the engines were drawn by horses, what became of Cecilia is a mystery to me, but her sister, Grace, would live to visit and grieve in my father's living room. The loss of her daughter, her expression distant as a lost ship at sea. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long way from home. And music from a different era. Oops. No, that's not the one I thought it was. Okay. Stranger than known. My parents, both with two marriages, loved my sisters, each other and me, but I wonder how, now that I'm older, bad luck and bad judgment at times would blur to simply the trials that we bore. Blue smoke rings drifting to the ceiling. First one mastectomy, then another. Secondhand smoke, not as yet invented. What conversations should have been had in those days of Winston's taste good? People just whispered about cancer and never dreamt of telling the kids. The station wagons had no seat belts. Carbon tetrachloride in an unmarked tin under the kitchen sink, and the town fogged DDT to kill the mosquitoes. The way back of the family wagon, facing the retreating road backwards, was a nice spot to sit and read books. Speeding along with the wind, yanking the book in my hand, Disney's Dumbo, silver and black edge, little golden book. Dad said sharply, "Hang on to it," just as Dumbo flew out the window. A fluttering dead thing on the pavement, receding, receding in our wake. Dad refused to stop, and I might have cried a few tears. I can't remember. One more step in the long-running fight over how I always read too much. And one year, they hid all of the books except the Bible, so I read the Bible. I truly adored music in my teens. I'd catch the train to Boston with my friends to attend concerts at the Tea Party, Brooklyn Street at first, later on Lansdowne. We were at the Lansdowne place, I believe, that night when I heard Colosseum and the Birds in laid-back, unflappable country mode, and decided afterwards to hitchhike home. The night's ride was a Dumbo leap of faith. Some guy gave us a lift in Everett and took us up into the hills of the Middlesex Fells, where the fells way weaves darkly past rock cuts and looming, leaning trees and then plunges downhill for miles to the edge of Stoneham. The guy claimed he was trying to save gas as he killed the engine, slipped the car into neutral, turned all the lights off, and started gliding. Ghosts of the future, down from Puritan Hills, we descended silently towards the suburbs. There's more. Come on, you. Oh, there it is. I do a comic routine, too. Near the Stoneham Zoo, he switched the engine back on and brought up the lights. I wondered if the sleeping elephants had had weird dreams, disturbing visions of humans flying. When Dad passed away decades later, I was cleaning junk out of his cellar. And I found that Dumbo book in a cardboard box. Marred by tire tracks, pages torn out. The old man had gone back after all, without saying so much as a word. I picture him waiting for darkness to come before running his silent errand. Thank you. That's very kind.
Great. Yeah. Thank you.
I would like to introduce one of the best living poets in Canada. John Barton is here with his latest book of poetry, Compulsory Figures. He's not just a great poet, he's an amazing editor and one of the dynamos that keeps Canadian poetry running. So I won't go on for too much longer. So please give it up for John Barton.
Thank you, Eric. I don't know if I'll be as energetic. But, you know, vive la différence, right?
Wait.
So, Compulsory Figures just came out about 2 months ago. And I'm going to read the title poem. In a way, it is where the book started. 10 years ago, one of my sisters died suddenly from an aneurysm. And somebody told me, somebody told me that in some ways the death of a sibling is maybe the hardest, because they're with you at the beginning and you expect them to be with you through the end as the witness. Mm-hmm. You know, your parents predecease you, but you kind of think they're going to carry forward with you, and then they don't. So after she died, I had one of those fearful moments where I thought, I don't remember anything about her. And but one of the things I did remember is that when I was, she was 6 years older than me, she figure skated in her teens. And so I thought, I will use that as the way in. And so I chose the circle 8 figure as the figure that I was going to use. And so the poem is constructed of 8 stanzas. Each stanza is 8 lines, and each line is 8 syllables. And then the 8 stanzas, each is on a part break between them where the syntax jumps across the break. So this is the title poem, Compulsory Figure. Our past is a community rink visibly inscribed. The blades of the white skates you're laced into, transferring circle 8s onto the ice. Decades before I thought to remember, I am watching you turn in a short flaring skirt when, at 13, you work hard to slip from blade edge to tendered blade edge, your eight circles cut into the flooded and frozen expanse of light. Each one burnished, a shadow outlined in silver, skates canting in sync from axis to axis as you turn, friction firing from each twist what looked like frost bangles fused at a single jeweled point. Your weight angling from hip to hip as you wheel, lifting after a thrust, your right foot as, without wobble, you glide, having first set down your left, eight assured, overlapping circles I hadn't grasped are graved into the thin plate of what I recall, its zinc duller than the opaque, shining surface you score. The nicks from which I start to pull instant impressions of you turning and turning as you blur with focused longing through iterations of each evolving aspiration into the incisive woman I know you have turned into, sitting next to me at the rink, ghosting the traces of girls like you who claim the ice, who after perfecting their compulsory figures outshine the bright, short-lived moon of their spotlights to escape, mindless spinning, without warning, a stroke striking you, your skating circles of thought stopped, chilling me, my skating cut loose from your brain's sliding impress, sped to brightness, its practice more sure than my own, heart and mind caught on the edges of your agile-footed dreaming, the blunted anguish exact jumps I improvise in arenas overdramatically lit, ornament looping past figures pulled into muscle memory, spins I can't break from, teetering symbols put on ice to ignore, balance all my circle eights rash, a spiral downward, this program you would curb, though I am falling, falling with such brave certainty, white roses hail down on the ice, my technique expressive, if not faultlessly expressed, you no longer in the stands, tough-minded and clear-eyed, my attentive audience. So I keep describing this book as my first book of free verse in, I don't know, 15 years, and I keep reading all the formal poems from this book. And so this poem is a cento. And so if you don't know what a cento is, you take lines from another poet and you arrange them into lines of your own. A poem of your own, and so I chose to make a cento from a poem by Carolyn Forché from called On Earth. This is a 40-page poem, and it's an Apsidarian poem. And if you don't know what an Apsidarian poem it is, each line in the poem would start with a different letter of the alphabet in alphabetical order. So there's pages of A, pages of B, pages of C all the way through, and I chose a line from each letter group. So my poem is an Apsidarian cento, which kind of was easy because, of course, her order predicated my order. And I chose as the title a line from the poem, naturally, which is Le Musée Hypnothétique, the Hypothetical Museum. Le Musée Hypnothétique, Hypothétique. Apparition in a vacant house, blue lobelia rising along the gate, city through the filth of a bus window, down a desert road airily strafed. Each page a window intact until touched, from a gloved hand a flaming bottle. Ground fog rising from a graveyard, history decaying into images. I remember standing next to his bed, journey that will have no end. Keepsake, Nell, Kiri, lighted paper sacks sent downriver to console. Meaning did not survive that loss of sequence near the lake where the fireweed was. One sees and is seen approaching the other with empty hands, present though most often invisible. Question after question rises as wet smoke. So this is how the past begins. Tedium taught me an imaginary world. Under the blind skies, surveillance, vesture, vigil, light, votive, writing, an anguished wind, X does not equal your light, narrow coffin, zero. So, coincidentally, I have one or two poems that have a connection to Eastern Ontario and Kingston. My great-grandparents lived here. In fact, he was commanded the base here during the First World War. My grandparents were married here, and my mother was born here. Anyway, sometime in the 40s, my grandmother's great-grandmother's coach house burnt down. And why that's important to this poem is this poem is inspired by a drawing that was done of my great-great-great-great-grandfather in London in 1830, where he is dressed in the costume, he's going to costume ball as Henry VIII. And his costume had survived 100 years, and then it was lost in that fire. I have the portrait in my home. And the man who drew it, John Tenniel, who did the first illustrations to Alice in Wonderland. And he did it as a very young man. So the poem begins with an epigraph from Lewis Carroll. Everything's got a moral, if only you can find it. Masquerade. 20 years before John Tenniel could limn his name, plummeting sketch over sketch with Alice down her rabbit hole, Big Ben's hands not yet sweeping across the full moon of the Hatter's watch to track not hours or minutes, but days and years. My forebear, 5 generations back, having sailed from Lower Canada to London for the season, posed for him in ermine and hose, a single ostrich feather dandled to his shoulder from a floppy cobalt beretta, face ruffed in honeycombs of starched lace to hold the jowls stiff as they rose out of a robin's egg blue jerkined latticed in gilt filigree, the skirt flaring from a cinched waist above knees thrown wide, feet slipped into duck bill shoes while he leaned legless upon rails of a swiftly cross-hatched king's chair, the sleeves of his inky box coat puffed, the 4th glass of claret he kept raising, still undrained, semi-precious stones adorning his attire, all paste, although the candle-lit lusters got him to look larger and by divine right apparently more well-suited to reign. A 3rd queen and sickly heir sketched also, the drawings he would hand down from branch to attenuated branch of a family tree so fruitful with rumor, its crown spreads low to the ground, windfalls inherited by son after son rolling away, if not their assumed taste for authority, the bespoke trinity of disguises my ancestor had made to measure for his boy, wife, and himself, lost to fire a century later, the coach house behind my widowed great-grandmother's home during the Second World War, peaceably burning to the ground, scant city blocks from Lake Ontario's parched, flinty surface, my mother leaving this costume ball, good King Hal, to me, so he may hang in the scruffy foyer of my one-bedroom apartment, where sun can't make each wash of color any lighter. Plasterboard frame, plasterwork frame, crumbling curlicue upon curlicue, cuttings of clingy gold leaf fitfully dropping free, only eyes as blue-gray as my own, gazing back icily while anchoring airless nostrils, the lips unambiguously thin beneath a spruce red beard, caught talking by the slurred traces of graphite in the faint preparatory drawing. Young Tenniel mastering sleight of hand for Alice's unyielding half-dream world of bigger and smaller proportions, the short sword he sketched to balance on the pivot of Henry's knee, never, as far as I know, drawn from the tortoiseshell scabbard, its imagined power laid to rest on my desk as a sham vestige of what's real. And I do have the sword. And it is tortoise shell. Three years ago, I had the good fortune of spending 5 weeks at the A-Frame, Alperdi's A-Frame. And one of my obligations was to give a workshop. And so I decided to give a workshop on how, you know, writing poems in reference or in reverent tribute to another poet. Of course, I had to write poems about Alperdi. And in order to illustrate the techniques, I had to write the poems. So I ended up writing a lot more poems about Alperdi than I planned. And so one of the forms of tribute, of course, is the glossa. And so I wrote a glossa. And if you don't know what a glossa is, you take four lines by another poet and use it as the last line of one of four stanzas. And then there's a, you know, little big rhyme scheme thrown in. I actually just used the lines as part of my own lines. And I guess the other thing that's important to know is that my ancestors settled on Amherst Island in 1820. They were late loyalists that arrived from the States in 1799. So before I went to the Purdy A-Frame, the house still stands on Amherst Island, and I was able to stay there for one night. So, and I took, as my lines from Purdy are from the country north of Belleville. And these are the lines. Old fences drift vaguely among the trees, a pile of moss-colored stones, gathered for some ghost purpose, has lost meaning under the meaningless sky. And just one final thing, just remember I wrote this just after the convoy. So, okay. Approaching Purdy Country. Except through hearsay, I have not been this way before, only just as far as Amherst Island, in the county next door, where last night I slept in a farmhouse my ancestors called Poplar Dell, the gray mitered stone bivouacking me quarried in 1839. The present owners tell me by Kingston Penn's early lifers, the humbling sweep of the breeze through branches tapping me awake under eaves archly raked at first light. Old Isaac's eyes probing mine from his gilt frame, while sculpted from scree, old fences drift vaguely among the trees. As I reverse, wave, and pull away to fall in line for the ferry, almost not finding the right gear to drive on board, en route to Ameliasburg, and to stay on time by intemperately speeding past cemeteries, hosting unalike loyalists, this less than willing land, seldom both starved and broke, their bountiful faith atoned by rote, homesickness somehow withstood inside homesteads, subsidence cannot stop eating to the bone, a pail of moss-colored stones. To make rough note of, as my car sails nearer, the loyalist highway I tack, hewing to the shore of the North Channel, just outside the reach of greater waters, where landlocked ships the locals built woodenly performed the lake battles of 1812 and later. After the second ferry docks me in Purdy's County, I step foot on what I may compass, fishing from the shallow family histories I harbor, how Isaac's daughter in 1837 ran from rebels with 12 apocryphal spoons smithed in Armagh, caught in her bosom, handed forward untarnished by trespass or apology, gathered for some ghost purpose. I may have come to Roblin Lake to comprehend, or resisting doubt, it's possible I'm here to rebuke fence by collapsing fence, the six generations who caused me to be born, not in the country of their defeat, as I'm first to believe, but in the scarcely sovereign dominion they without struggle or knowing became. A founding almost on the fly, our common Church of England despair overshadowed with little trouble by praise. Freedom convoy ensigns, when wind battered everywhere I look in loyalist country as I park beneath a maple, though the topographic map I forgot to buy has lost meaning under the meaningless sky. And just to carry forward the sort of the my family's kind of implication in the history of this country, I'm going to read a poem about one of my father's ancestors who was how I was raised. He was third in command at the Battle of the Plains of Abraham, and so Wolfe died. The second in command was grievously injured, and my ancestor, I believe, signed the terms of capitulation. So when I went to a French-speaking college at the University of Alberta, I said, well, you can blame me, it's okay. And I begin it with a quote from the American gay photographer David Wojnarowicz, who died of HIV in the early 90s, and he wrote a memoir called Close to the Knives, and I found this line particularly compelling. In loving him, I saw men encouraging each other to lay down their arms. Plains of Abraham. Ask to answer for you, my ancestor, for the blood you let spill across this once conquered plateau, above where a serene river narrows and your troops had gathered. To stake claim after Wolfe and Montcalm fell, I weather the blame. Remorse unfolding on land two armies stole and occupied but couldn't share. The spring casting its spell while I walk with a man who grew up here. The damp ambush of branches ringing us, still naked. Leaves to come, a screen for lust, should we kiss? Sharp tongue, sleet icing our hair. How we've come together, not reliant on guns hailing lead. The new growth pliant. And that was a sonnet, if you didn't notice, as verifying that I just read the formal poems. And this poem is also formal. It's a triolet, and you'll hear the form as I read it. Bushed. After, you lean heavy against me. We are horses seeking warmth. In dusk woods standing asleep, after you lean heavy against me. Breeze on exposed skin, as rough leaves loud as white water tangle overhead. After, you lean heavy against me. We are horses seeking warmth. And not to be outdone by Eric, I'm going to read my Patti Smith poem. But I'm, as you probably can tell, I'm a bit more restrained. So, and this is a formal poem, too. It's a ballad. The Triumph of Patti Smith. While she's perched reading on a stoop in Edge City, New Jersey, crime can't edge much closer. It's missteps stepping past this porch, nothing dimmed in her parents' house behind scrims of elm. The girl left undisturbed as Rimbaud and Blake imbibe her, their refusals not to be curbed. Hoarding warmth under the marquee of the Chelsea Hotel, she meets Robert to check in. The brass key to who they are, no night clerk keeps behind the desk. A lock none breach, though his lens and lusts later stir up death on HIV's downbeat. His refusals not to be curbed. She'd have tried, if music allowed, to call him back. Her unceasing car alarm contralto, endowed with chant-like vigor to appease and vitalize the flesh, at ease as grief's witness, her acerbic, hollered words descanting release, her refusals not to be curbed. Mouth agape from the lachrymose, an ear attuned to the unheard, I am hoarse, thunderous with loss, my refusals not to be curbed. So I'm going to read two more poems, one a formal poem and one final free verse poem. And this is, I always get the name wrong, but it's a sonnet variation called The Duplex. And it was devised by the American queer poet Jericho Brown. And again, I think you'll hear this, how the poem works and the reading of it. And it's based on a dream I had, a very little tiny dream I had about 30 or so years ago, maybe 40, about two friends of mine who were making peas and carrots. And I was in therapy at the time, and my therapist was absolutely desperate for me to have a dream that he could analyze. And so I brought this dream in, and he thought, peas and carrots, separate but together. Okay. So that's where this poem started. Peas and carrots. I shall while he scrubs, peels and dices. Love a shell we peel, curl inside. Loneliness a shell, hulling us from inside. What's boiled found to taste better with butter. The boiling point reached, makeup sex goes buttery. I wash the plates before he starts to clean up. Should we shower apart? We don't feel clean. In pots on the boil, bugs rise to the top. Orange not boiling dry with green on the stove top. mixed singularities served with every meal. Love and loneliness spooning our usual meal. So usual a side dish with heat going soft. Fridge cold, not restoring crunch to softness. I shell while he scrubs, peels, and dices. The last poem, and the last poem in the book, after my sister died, a friend of mine encouraged me to join him in San Francisco. He was going down there for a conference. Didn't think about it really except to go, and realized when I got there that it was Gay Pride. And Gay Pride in San Francisco is, you know, MC, you know, it's just really huge. And it just coincided, it was the year that gay marriage was declared legal in the United States by the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was just 2 days before the parade. So you can imagine what the parade was like. And they had the two men who, you know, led the, who's, the plaintiffs, they were there in the parade. And what I didn't realize about the San Francisco Gay Pride Parade is it goes on for hours, absolutely hours. And I kept thinking, why are people walking away? And after 5 hours, I thought, I know why. My feet were killing me. Anyway, so all of that gets massaged into this poem. And I decided to begin it with an epigraph from Corinthians. It is better to marry than to burn. From a rise overlooking the bay, the men's chorus sings as one in Grace Cathedral at the crown of Nob Hill. One page in the log of HIV dead turned per day in an alcove. Leaves illumined by time's troubled proprietary gaze. Incense and shadow, candles put to the match, organ stentorian, rose window a burst of wonderment at how little you have altered in the years since my prime, our brief union an aside handwritten behind the impress of constant strangers in my arms, half grasped in estranged camaraderie. A skeleton key of whistle stops through the Castro, thinning men fragmented into isolates, as incongruent as zones of the continent. Borders artificial, landmass one of ravishment. Men with names I am not equal to, can't think to forget. Dyslexic register of where I've traveled, jumbled toward the present. A churn of wake opaque behind the ferry, enticing us across the bay from Sausalito. Our absolute amicability an anchor, with less drag than the allure docking has. Alcatraz iconic and is inescapable, held without trial in the morning haze late June feeds off of. Sun resistant to longing, entangled in harbored currents. Commuters commuted to tourists. The Pride Parade 8 hours long, and not even the product branded length of Market Street. No one with stamina ready on infinite asphalt to give witness start to finish. The ecstatic plaintiffs for marriage in a convertible inching past. Love, stop and go, slow and fast. Thank you for listening.
Now, you may not have any questions, but if you do, we'll listen to them and we might even answer.
Well, I'll answer for him.
Yeah.
And he might answer for me.
Tag, you're it.
Anybody? Yes.
John, I don't remember how your passion for formal poetry. Could you tell us a little bit more? Like, are you an instructor of poetry and therefore you are a student of it with great
You know, when it comes down to it, I got bored with writing free verse. You know, form is the great boogeyman. Most people think it's a limiting thing. And so around 2007, I started playing around with it, and I published a book called Polari in 2014, where I tried writing poems in about 30 different forms. And then, well, around 2016, when I was still, I was at that time, I was the editor of the Manhattan